All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears? What's happening? You all right? You holding up? You okay? You locked in? If you're new to this show, this is a good day to be here. Eddie Murphy is here. Well, I talked to him, and the recording of that is here. Couple of things before we get to Eddie, before I set that up. I don't know if I won or not. Okay, I'm recording this the day before the Critics' Choice Awards. So today, those results would be out. So what I'm going to do now is tell you how I'm feeling heading into that, because I have to do that show from my dining room. Here's how it's been set up to me, and if any of you watched it, you'll know. Maybe. I don't know what the fuck. I could have a heart attack shortly after I record this. But it was going to be, I think it was me and Patton and Hannah and Fortune and Michelle, Jerry Seinfeld. Do you need last names? Patton Oswalt, Fortune Feimster, Hannah Gatsby, Michelle Bateau, and me and Jerry Seinfeld. I'm nominated for End Times Fun. I'm proud of that. Took a long time to put it together. It's a beautiful, beautiful special collaborative effort by me and the late great Lynn Shelton, who directed it. But I never win anything. I'm going to be doing stand-up comedy professionally. That means making a living at it, one way or the other, for 33 years. Come August, this August. So add another 3 or 4 to that. Ish from starting out. So 37 years, 36 years I've been doing this. And the only real award I can remember winning for my stand-up comedy was coming in second place in the WBCN Comedy Riot in 1988, and that's what started me working. That was the last time I think I won a prize for my stand-up of any value. I'm prepared to lose, and I'll be there on camera losing. So you will have seen that. And if I win, it would break a historical losing streak for me and any sort of award. So that's where I'm at. I'll let you know how I feel after the show on Thursday. So look, Eddie Murphy, there was a time when we were younger, all of us, and there was nobody bigger than Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy was the biggest star in the world for a long time. Nobody was bigger than Eddie Murphy. And I don't even think we remember when the media and entertainment universe was smaller what that meant. But those first few movies, like Beverly Hills Cop, 48 Hours, Trading Places, SNL, Delirious, the comedy special, huge global domination. And the truth is, he has stayed a vital part of show. He's had a career in show business for, what, 40 years or something? But the interesting thing about him, you know, outside of him being naturally fucking hilarious, and then there was those years where people were always like, is he still funny? Is he going to be funny? Is he going to act funny? They'd see him on shows. Would he act funny? Even back in the day, he would make a choice whether he was going to act funny or not, what he would and wouldn't do, however he felt. Sometimes he was sort of dickish about it, and sometimes rightfully so. I mean, I watch a lot of stuff just to get Eddie in my head, and it was just very interesting to see him on old Johnny Carson clips, where his talent and his sort of demeanor was so huge. He was so effortlessly funny. And he was so sort of at odds just naturally and for, you know, personal reasons and probably for racial reasons with the entertainment industry in a way. Just to see him with Carson and to see Carson trying to goad him into doing a Bill Cosby impression. Just Eddie is sort of like, not going to do it. And deciding he wouldn't do it just because he didn't feel like it. He didn't want to be told what to do. It really was reflective of the sort of weird expectation. He definitely played with the racial expectation of black entertainers at that time, you know, on several appearances on Letterman, on Carson, where they would constantly get him to try to do impressions, or they would ask him what he does with his money. And he, you know, brought to their attention that these were specifically questions that were unique to black guests. And why him? But it was also that I don't think anybody knew what to do with a guy who became that big a star so quickly. But the bottom line is, man, is he had the goods. He had effortlessly had the fucking goods, man. I mean, he could riff like Robin. He was quick. He could do voices. He could mimic. He could do quick jokes. He had a long sort of deep reservoir of references. And he just wouldn't play the game if he didn't want to. He didn't give a fuck. Zero fucks. And it was sort of fascinating to see him kind of arc and just sort of continue to be part of show business, but not be as necessarily himself as he used to be, or what we knew him to be when he was young. He's only a couple of years older than me. He's got 10 kids. So heading into this thing, yeah, I didn't know how I was going to do it, because it's a big career, big personality, and you don't really know. I didn't really know, you know, who is Eddie really, and is he going to be funny? Is he going to be funny? Is he going to be detached? I didn't know. So the way that I dealt with Eddie was I was going to deal with him as a comic. He was a comic. He was a real comic. He was a guy that wanted nothing more than to do comedy all his life. And although his two comedy specials, Delirious and Raw, are definitely very different in tone and different in terms of where he was with his ego and with his success, but he was the real deal. And he was doing comedy when he was like 16 years old. So I thought, I talked to Chris Rock years ago about him and just about, you know, his time at the comic strip, his time doing those gigs in New York and Long Island, Florida. You know, he was a 17-year-old kid who had a gift as a comic. He had a depth to it that was almost a prodigy-like. And he knows who his heroes are. This was a kind of an amazing conversation about people we both knew, people that, you know, he revered, you know, Richard Pryor specifically, and, you know, his experience around that. But, you know, just also just kind of, yeah, I'll be honest with you, before we head into the interview, I did try to, you know, kind of figure out why he had a chip on his shoulder when he was at the top of his game. But, you know, he didn't really see it that way. So there is a little bit of persistence on my part around that, because, you know, I like to connect around the anger, you know. This was a great conversation, and I was just so thrilled, to be honest with you. Like, you never know. Like I said, I think I told you this the other day, you know, back in the day when we were doing this at the house, you know, I'd get to talk with the guys, talk with the ladies, whoever was on, he, she, them. And, you know, they'd come to my house, we'd warm up a little bit, and then we'd get into it. But you never know with the Zoom. You get on, you do the tech thing, make sure everything's tight, and then you get into it. So how do you connect? And I tell you, man, you know, Eddie got on, and he was in his house. He's in a room with wooden, like, panel wood, beautiful wooden walls. There were some candles behind him, and he was in this this red seating arrangement. And he was just sitting there, and it looked very specific to me. So what I'm referencing at the beginning of this is because that was the image I was looking at. Eddie sitting in a red upholstered seating situation that I couldn't see the edges of. Behind him, just this stained, beautiful, old-looking wood wall of wooden panels and candles. And that's how he came in. And this is how I came in. So this is me talking to Eddie Murphy. The movie is that he's promoting is Coming to America with the two, Coming to Number Two America. That's the sequel. It's now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Also, toward the beginning of this, I mentioned Richie to him, and that's his old manager, Richie Tinkin, who just passed away last week. And here we go. Enjoy me and Eddie Murphy. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever.
The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. How you doing, Eddie?
I'm good, man. How you?
I'm okay, man. It's nice to see you.
Yeah, same here.
I've noticed in some of your other interviews that the candles were lit behind you, but I guess not today. It's okay.
Did you turn the candles off? He made mention of it. He said, I noticed the candles were lit in the other.
I don't need the candles. I don't need them. It's not video.
No, now you're going to put them on. Now, we have to put them on. Because if you didn't want them, you wouldn't have said anything.
I just didn't know if they were real. Someone said that they were like a light, but it's a real candle, huh?
Yeah, they just burnt down really low.
Isn't that petty of me? I'm like, hey, you know, I saw you on Fallon and the candles were lit. What the fuck
the
is that about?
The candles
were
lit.
What am I? Then, nothing?
Then you tune in. I don't even get a candle?
Where's my fucking candle?
What's with the dry candles? What's with the dry candles back then? So we're going to make it nice for you, Mark.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Two more?
Two more.
Do you have nice. What kind of, where are you sitting? Do you have a steakhouse at your place?
No. You know, he just asked me, he said, where are you sitting? Do you have a steakhouse at your place? No, this is the lounge. There's a bowling alley here, not a steakhouse.
Really?
And this is the lounge right by the bowling alley, so. Booths and stuff.
Oh, how many lanes you got?
Two lanes.
Open to the public or just private? Or
nah, it's all private.
Do you have to rent shoes over there? What do you got going on?
The shoes come complimentary with your steak.
How you feeling? What's going on with the how much material did you have in place before you had to put the kibosh on that tour you were going to do?
How much material?
I mean, were you working shit out or what?
See, but we have to use the word material loosely. Because it's not like I write. When they have a conversation, you say something funny, and if you're working out, just go try it out at the club.
Yeah.
Well, now I'll just, when that happens, I just say it in the phone.
Yeah.
And I have, so I probably got, 2-3 hours of, one, two, three line premises I have to give some structure to.
I don't want to be presumptuous. I think you should just release those phone memos. I mean, I think that... just have you going, it's dogs and... what I'm
dogs
saying.
Dogs and mayonnaise. You'd be like, what the fuck is this dogs and mayonnaise bit going to be?
you ever get so far away from those notes where you don't even know what the fuck you're talking about?
Oh, yeah, when you find it, what the fuck, the perfect example, the mayonnaise. That's 5 years late I found something that said mayonnaise. What the fuck was mayonnaise?
It was important at the moment.
Yeah, it was going to kill. That was going to be my killer bit back then, to the point where you wrote it down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I do that, too. I just make the outlines. I don't write the jokes. I just do the trigger words, the button words. And then I'm like, oh, okay, I'm going to remember that.
That's from doing stand-up for years and years and years.
Well, yeah, but that's always how I did it. I was sorry to hear about Richie. I don't know how close you guys were, but I was sorry to hear about that.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that the other day. Yeah, man, he's part of my, my history, Richie.
For sure. Yeah, right? He was all... Do you remember meeting that guy?
Oh, yeah. I remember, back in the early 80s, the late 70s, the comic strip.
So where you were, you grew up where?
I grew up, I was born in Brooklyn, lived in Brooklyn until I was 11. Then I moved out to Long Island, Roosevelt, Long Island.
So what was the deal out there? I mean, were you like, when did you start getting involved with, knowing that the comedy was a thing?
Comedy wasn't a thing back then. It wasn't no thing. It was like in New York, you had Catch a Rising Star,
yep.
The Improv,
yep.
And the comic strip. And that was in the city.
Yeah.
Out on Long Island, you didn't have nothing. It was no comedy clubs. There was one club called, was it, remember a dude back in the 70s, this Richard Nixon lookalike named Richard M. Dixon? It was a guy, he had a comedy club on Long Island.
He
it was
did?
Richard M. Dixon's White House Inn. And on Wednesday nights, he would have comedy nights. And we would, that's, I started working out there.
You did?
When I was about 16, yeah.
And that was the only joint? Governors wasn't there
was
yet?
Where the hell was it? There was no Governors. There was none of it. There was no East Side Comedy Club. None of that stuff was out there yet.
Man, I remember going to Governors. The last time I played Governors, you could still smoke in there.
Yeah, I never, like, I never played Governors. What was the other one, too? It was a rock place we used to play. My Father's Place. You remember that place?
Yeah, I know.
Spira Gyra was there every week.
They had had their time. So it was just you and Charlie?
No, Charlie wasn't doing stand-up back. He wasn't
But
doing
I mean, he's the only sibling, just the two of you?
Oh, no. I have a younger brother who's like 6 years younger.
Yeah? What's he do?
We have different dads.
Oh. Uh-huh.
So his name is Lynch.
Oh, okay.
And what's he do? He's a bunch of different stuff. He's a martial artist. He trains his son. Son is a boxer. He trains him. You know, he does a bunch of different things.
So Vernon Lynch was your stepfather.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I don't like to say that because he kind of raised me.
From when you were a kid, right?
Yeah.
See, he's your father.
Yeah, he's my dad.
And how close is that version of him that you did on Delirious? How close is that?
Hey, you know what's the trip? My dad was like that when we was young, and because of that sketch or that, whenever I would do that, him on stage,
yeah,
nobody would be laughing harder than my mother, because it was true. Because my dad had a drinking problem,
right?
I could be like it, and 10,000 people, and my mother would be screaming, and because of that, my dad stopped drinking.
Really?
He stopped drinking because of those bits.
Well, that's
funny, but yeah, he was a lot like, he was just like that when he was.
Oh my God! Drinks. So you had to deal with all that insanity, the volatility all the time.
Not all the time, just every now and then. You know.
Oh yeah, right. and you
it
knew
it wasn't every night.
You knew when it was going to happen, right? You knew the tone.
Yeah, but when it would happen, it wasn't funny. It was like serious.
Scary.
Your dad, yeah, scary. But when you get for a comedian, that turns into one of your best bits.
Exactly. And also, like, when you grow up in that shit, there's two ways to go. Either you make it funny and you learn how to figure out how to survive and manage it, or, you get fucked up yourself and you chose the other. You chose the, I'm going to make this funny and survive this shit.
Yeah, I never drank. I don't drink.
I imagine if you grow up with someone like that, you why would you? You're scared of it.
Yeah, but you're either going to do, people wind up drinking or not. I went the other way.
You were like, nope.
Yeah, nothing.
I want to stay in charge of me.
Yeah.
And so when you were, who were the first comics that you were looking at that made you, that brought you some, because I imagine it's the same with you. You watch the comics and it made you feel better about life.
For me, it was the first person I looked at going, okay, this is, I'm into this and this is somebody doing comedy was Richard Pryor, that first album of not his first album. It was in 1972. He did an album called That Nigga's Crazy.
Yeah.
72, 73.
Right.
That album just changed everything for me. I used to sit and listen to it every day over and over and over and over. Not even, and the first 6 months I was laughing.
But yeah.
Then, you just sit and just listening to it over and over and over and over and over.
Right. And yeah. What was the big bit on that record? Which was the bit that made you like that you couldn't get out of your head?
The whole album, the Wino and Dracula. You ever hear that one?
Yeah.
No, he just goes, hey, you fool, you peeping in the windows, people's in the window. You with the cape? What you doing, peeping in the people's window? What's your name, fool? Dracula. Yeah, you ugly motherfucker.
Yeah, what kind of name is that? Right.
What kind of name is that for a nigga?
Yeah.
Where you from, true? Transylvania. Yeah, I know where it is, motherfucker. You ain't the smartest motherfucker in the world, but you is the ugliest. Oh, yeah, you ugly motherfucker. Why don't you get your teeth fixed, nigga? Shit hanging all out your mouth. Why don't you get your orthodontist? That's a dentist, Ha, ha.
Yeah, that laugh.
Yeah.
So that was it, man. That was the thing that blew your mind.
Blew my mind. And I had seen, watched Sullivan and seen, you know, Carlin and seen all that stuff. Flip Wilson, loved Flip Wilson when I was a kid. Everybody loved Flip Wilson.
Geraldine, he had his own show, man. He had his own show.
One of the biggest shows.
Yeah, it's great.
And but everybody would be on that show. I loved him. I thought he was hysterical. But I never thought of, you know, when I would see him do stand-up, it wasn't like I was like, oh, yeah, that's...
Right.
I saw Richard.
Right.
That's when it was like, yo, that's... I'm this thing.
It always amazes me too, like when I watch Richard now, like the vulnerability of the guy. Like the guy was so, like when you learn about him, about his, like, you know, there was always, you know, his broken heart was always right under the surface, you know, and you could always feel the humanity of the guy. It's amazing. Doesn't matter what the bit was. It was just like, he was all in, man.
Yeah, man. He's the real deal.
And when did you start, like, what else did you start putting together to start thinking about how you were going to approach it other than Richard?
Well, when I first started doing it, it was mostly impressions.
Uh-huh.
That's the easiest way to get on stage.
Right.
Is do impressions. Because if you sound like it, that's it. You don't have to have a personality. You don't have to have any jokes. Just sound like the person that you're doing.
Yeah.
So I was always a good mimic. So that's how I, when I first,
the guys?
I would do Richard, I would do Muhammad back then. This is how long ago it was. I would do Jimmy Carter because he was the president. Yeah. And I would do Ali and Cosell, all that stuff that they would do on the Wide World of Sports. I would do all of that stuff. Al Green and shit.
Yeah.
And I was always really, really good at doing voices.
And that's how you started to do the
that's how I started getting on stage.
The open mics. Stuff,
doing, yeah. Actually, wasn't no open mics back then. Back then, they used to have the, remember the gong show in the 70s?
Yep.
Well, the bars used to have gong show night. So you would find different gong show nights. I would go to the gong show nights, win $25.
But you got some chops. So when do you head into the city? I mean, how does that take place? And what's your parents thinking about it?
Well, my parents don't really know how much, they don't know the extent of it. Like, they know that I'm doing some stuff, but they don't know that, you know, okay, by 11th grade, I'm like, you know, I'll go say I'm staying over at my friend Clint's house.
Yeah.
And I'll go to the comic strip, you know,
at night.
And then the next day, miss school and shit. By 12th grade, I was like, she didn't know the extent of it. But they never were tripping about it because they didn't know about it. Then when I started making some paper, it was all good. And that's, I started making money from it really early. I got on SNL when I'm 19, but the year before that, I'm kind of like a working comic. I'm like working regularly, all the little, whatever little spots they were back
doing
then.
Doing one-nighters with Joey Vega, maybe Fred Stoller.
Yeah, Fred Stoller, yes. Yes, absolutely. I did the comic strip in Fort Lauderdale with Fred Stoller.
Yeah.
We went jet skiing.
You and Fred?
He went and fell off the jet ski. And, because the it was making him nauseous.
Who were the other guys that were there? Was Dennis Wolfberg there? Who was there?
Dennis Wolfberg, absolutely, yes. Dennis Wolfberg, yes. He used to crush every night. Wolfberg, who's with Steve Middleman?
Steve Middleman, no chin. He has no chin.
Yes, yeah. I have no chin. That was his killer bit.
Yeah, that was the whole bit.
I actually was in a big laugh-off in the 1980s. 79, 80 with Steve Middleman. He won. I came in fifth.
I came in fifth.
Middleman came in first. I think Carol Leifer came in second, and Mark Schiff came in. He came in third.
Won't work on Fridays.
Is that true?
Yeah, he became Orthodox. Mark Schiff is an Orthodox. There was a couple Orthodox guys back then. So you came in fifth, but you were like 17?
18, yeah.
So at 18, you're doing those one-nighters in Jersey and shit and, you know, like running around?
Yeah, and by the time I'm 18, there's a little bit of a circuit. When I started, there was no... When I'm 15, there's like, you know, gong show night and bars. Then by the time I'm 18, you got little, like a lot of places are having comedy nights, and there's a little bit of a circuit that you can go, and there's clubs you can go to. You can go to Philly and work the Comedy Works, or you could go to DC and work Garvin's Grill.
So you're doing all that at 18?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're meeting all the guys. You're meeting all the old weirdos, and you know you're digging. You're becoming a comic. So you're learning about all
But you know what? It's not. It wasn't a lot of comics.
Smaller community.
It was such a small community, and it was like now being a comic is like a mainstream.
Everybody
thing in show business. It's thousands of comics, but back then it was just a handful. Back then it was like being a magician or a mime or some shit.
It was you and Stoller and Middleman, and
it was a few more than that. Gilbert Gottfried,
yeah.
He was the genius of that period. He was the one when all the comics would go watch him every time he was up.
Did you like him?
Absolutely. Still, he makes me laugh.
He was like, and that's also, it was specifically New York. There was definitely a New York thing, and then people eventually came out to L.A., but I imagine, like, I guess most of the guys who started, like, Belzer was already gone, and those guys were already gone.
Yeah, Belzer had left.
But just
a year or two before I got out there, Belzer.
When you were doing the work, you know, people were saying, like, oh, that guy used to be at the club here, now he's in L.A. Everyone kind of go to L.A., right? Richard Lewis, all those people.
Yeah, those guys were older than me, so I was
gone.
I didn't know that those group of guys. And those guys were established comics back, like those guys were serious, real deal comics. We didn't even think of ourselves like
that. You remember Lucian?
Lucian Hole, yeah.
He I remember when I auditioned at the comic strip, he says, "Oh, I already have enough angry white guys."
He told me, "Your material's horrible, but you've got very strong stage presence." I was like, thank you. Your material's horrible.
So how did it unfold? So you're doing comedy, you know, you're paying your dues, and you got, what, you got an hour in 1980? When you're 17, 18, you got an hour?
Nah, they didn't. Back then, people weren't doing it. The hour, Richard made that popular.
Right.
Before then, it wasn't half an hour. You had a tight 10, and you had your shit that you had to work in front of, you know, if you got on a Tonight Show or if you got the Merv Griffin or something like that. But, you know, nobody was doing an hour. A big gig back then was opening for people. So you needed 10, 15 minutes of killer shit. So nobody's doing an hour. Like Richard Pryor in concert.
Right.
That kind of changed the whole comedy landscape. That became the standard way, the comic, you know, the headline comic is bringing an hour of shit. Richard started that.
I remember seeing that when I was in high school. It would change my entire life. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, man. Yeah, Richard is the what Marlon Brando is to acting. Richard is to stand up comedy.
How did you end up being managed by Richie and then getting SNL? Was that all through the comic strip?
Well, yeah, I was started work. The comic strip was the easiest club to get in because it's still real cliquish with comics.
Yeah.
And back then, all the comics kind of booked the clubs. So it was really, really cliquish. So it was impossible. It was impossible to get on at Catch.
Yeah.
And
the
improv was kind of snooty. And so the comic strip was the easiest place to work out.
That's funny because it's sort of still like that. The comic strip was always kind of the working class. It wasn't the celebrity hole. It wasn't like an old timey New York hole, but it was for like new young guys. It was always been like that. The comic strip.
It's still like that. I haven't been there in years.
It was just a place where a lot of guys from the island, a lot of working class comics could work. You know.
Well, that's how we got in there. I literally went down and got online and got the ticket and did the whole thing and auditioned. And Lucian told me, you know, my act is terrible, but you have presence. I was hanging out at the comic strip, getting those 2 o'clock spots. Those 2 a.m. spots.
Yeah.
And those kind of spots never bothered me to go up really, really late when it was silly and, you know,
nine
10
people
in there. Yeah. And you're playing for whoever you're hanging out with this in the back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always liked that. I was doing those spots enough that when they Saturday Night Live had their, they did like, when the original cast left, they went like a cattle call. And you know, they were looking for everywhere. And one day I went to the comic strip and Tinkin was like, "Yeah, Saturday Night Live is looking for a black guy. You should go down there and set up an audition for you." It's like, okay. they need a black guy.
Was he your manager then?
No. Back then, he just owned the club. He just owned the comic strip.
Yeah.
And him and Bob Wax.
Yeah, Bob Wax.
Yeah. I went down and got this show, and maybe a year into it, they started managing me.
And did you do that just because, like, all right, well, you know, these guys know me. I work at their club.
No, I was 19. I thought, you know, Richie was, you know, one of the a major player back yeah. then. He owned the comedy club, and Bob Wax was a lawyer. I was like, I'm gonna need a lawyer. And
he yeah,
was like, hey, my lawyer, my manager together, and you know.
So with that, with SNL, everything turned around really quickly, right? Like you became big quick.
Hindsight being 2020, yeah. But back then it didn't feel quick because I was 19. So, you know, it just felt like, you know, how can I even, it didn't feel quick, but it just felt like.
This is how it happens.
Yeah, this is how it happens.
Right, right, right. You had nothing to compare it to. So you're like, do comedy. I'm funny. Like, yeah. Let's go.
Yeah. Here okay. And then I got that. Then, again, this is what happened. Yeah. That's exactly what it was like. It totally took it for granted.
So when do you decide, like, because I immersed myself in some stuff because I was watching some stuff, some appearances that you made on different shows. And it's sort of interesting to see, like, what was the pressure that you felt almost immediately, you know, from, you know, once, I guess it was 48 Hours, which was the one that kind of blew it all open.
That's the first one, 48 Hours.
Yeah. So on SNL, you become this huge hit with all these characters and people love you. And then you do the movie. And I have to assume that pretty quickly you realize you miss doing comedy for strangers.
No, what happened was that was the way it was with that show. It was like, I think Chevy Chase was on there first. And
yeah.
It was like, you do this show and then you can get to do movies. You know, you build up a fan base and get people in there. Then you can go off and make movies. And that's what I thought the blueprint was.
So oh,
was
so like, you okay. knew that. So you thought,
well,
like,
I didn't know that. I was looking like, okay, now it's time to, I got offered these movies. The movie was a big hit.
Yeah.
And I had the other one, Trading Places, was coming. And it was like, been on the show 3 years and was like, okay, I could go make movies now. So it was, I was moving on because I was like, that's what you do. Right.
Right. In your mind. And I think if rightfully so, you're like, this is how show business works. This is exactly.
Well, this is how it works when you're on Saturday Night Live. That's what I was thinking.
And you were like the biggest star in the world. And I was just like, I can't, like, it's so weird to me. Here's what I gotta bring up, only because it's sort of bothering me. That, like, early on when you became huge and you were doing, like, Carson, and there was, you know, there was something about your confidence and your knowledge of, you know, who you were and what you were capable of that kind of rose above, you transcended that format. But it was just sort of interesting that these guys, you kept bringing it up over and over again on these talk shows. Like, why are you asking me these certain questions? Because, you know, why are you asking me, how'd I get big so quickly? Why are you asking me about what I'm doing with my money?
About my watch.
Yeah. Like that it was there specifically this list of black questions that these guys. And what I found when watching it is that there was sort of a weird kind of innate bias. It just happened in the questions they were asking.
And it wasn't weird. It was the 80s. It was a whole different world back then.
Yeah.
It was the old world back then still. Like the 70s and the 60s, it wasn't that far removed from that 1981.
Right, right.
So it's like sensibilities and, you know, and perceptions and what you could say and what you could, there was no politically incorrect. You could say whatever. You could do jokes. You could do the Polish jokes and you could say all kind. You could do everything back then.
But did you feel like they were trying to box you? Go ahead.
Not boxed in. It was, you know, I was calling for what it was when they would do something like
right.
I never felt boxed in. By
right.
It. But I was like, I wasn't surprised by it because those were the times.
Yeah.
And I was an anomaly. It was like the reason I blew up in films was because I'm the first African American to like the character in the movie to go into the white world and take charge in the world.
Yeah.
That was because usually the black character up until then the black character is the sidekick.
Yeah.
The black sidekick. But my character shows up in the first movie. I'm written like the sidekick. But if you watch the movie, he's not the sidekick.
Yeah.
He's The whole move, Nick Nolte's going, now what do we do, convict? What's our next move? Where do we go now? Tell me now, what happened now? And I'm going, we go this way, we go that way. Yeah. And they found that funny. Like that was, it's some shit that we just stumbled onto. It wasn't intentional.
Yeah.
It was like, the back then they used to say, he stole the scene. He stole the scene. Yeah. It's like, literally, this is not written for him to be like that. He stole the scene. So, but they thought that was really, really funny.
They stole it.
That's what made me.
They accused you of stealing. They accused you like that kid.
Yeah. Well, they know it wasn't written like that. Right. It's like you got Nick Nolte, you're 6'3", you know, blonde hair, blue eyed, you know, leading man, and they're watching me in the scene, so he must have stolen it. It wasn't written like this.
Do you think that was? Do you think that perception was racist?
Not at all. They hadn't seen it up until then. They hadn't seen it. So it was this new thing.
So you carved this. You carved this zone for yourself. You know.
I didn't carve it. That's the way it worked out. I wasn't carving it. It's like, it's not like you, the path that you wind up on, you carve the path. It's more, it's much more like that fucking, that feather in Forrest Gump where you're floating around and wherever you go. And that's it. So this is where I blew in this direction.
Right.
And it turned out like that.
When did you start having a friendship with Richard? When did you meet Richard?
Oh, we never had a friendship. Richard's like my dad's age.
Yeah.
And Richard, I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't do any drugs, I didn't do any of that stuff. So we were not in the same
zone,
social, orbit. Yeah. But when I met him, he was just as an artist.
Yeah.
He was super, super nice to me. I met him coming from Atlanta, and he was on the plane, and he was on the seat in front of me. And the stewardess told me when I was getting on the plane, she was like, Mr. Pryor's on the plane. I was like, Mr. Pryor? He's the first. I was and I had my first comedy record on a cassette. I went up to him. I said, Mr. Pryor, I'm Eddie Murphy. I'm a comedian. He said, oh, yeah, I know you are. I said, here's my record. Will you listen to it? He said, oh, and he was sitting up. And he had my headphones on. And I was in the back watching his head. And he would go, ha, 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 ha. And I'm in the back like,
oh, that's great.
Then I go up to him and he said, you are very funny. And he said, you remind me of me. You make me think of me. And I was like,
I did it.
Then when the plane lands, he goes, where are you staying? And I was like, I'm staying up Mandeville Canyon. And he was like, how many give you live home? And he fucking his car. The guy drove his car. Met him at the airport. He had a white Rolls.
Yeah.
And he drove me up to the place I was staying. And that's the, like, and imagine that's the first time you meet your idol. You meet him like that.
Yeah.
You meet him like that. And he listens to you. He's laughing at your shit. And then he drives you home and he's nice to you. It was like,
wow.
That was the first, that's how I met Richard.
To get that sort of validation, like, you remind me of me. And then you kind of look back at, you're kind of the next in line, right? It turns out.
I wasn't thinking of it like that.
No, I know.
Of it, and I wasn't thinking, I was just thinking like, I made Richard laugh.
Yes.
Shit. And he actually drove me home. I was like fucked up. Like I was like floating from it. And then he back then Richard was the biggest, biggest comedy star in movies and all that stuff. And like I said, he was older than me, so we didn't really hang out or anything.
But did you have sort of multiple, before Harlem Nights, did you have like a lot of time did you spend with him? Were you able to spend time with him at all?
Well, Richard used to, when Richard would go at the play down at the Comedy Store, all the comics would come down, and sit in the back and watch.
Did you used to do the Comedy Store?
When I was in LA, absolutely. If Richard Pryor was at the Comedy Store, everybody goes, and just in the back. And I had a bunch of nights like that. Then afterwards, he'd be in the main room late, holding court, and all the comics are sitting around late. So I did a bunch of that.
I was a doorman there for a couple of years back in 86. And there was that, I used to see Mooney all the time. And and Pryor started coming in after he burned himself up, trying to put it back together, And I got to see him a couple times.
I met him after he had went through all that shit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I met him after he was burnt up and was getting it together and all that. I never met that Richard.
Right. No, when I saw him, it was rough because like he would, you know, it was, you know, what was amazing about him, and I'm sure you know it, is like you would see him struggle. I mean, you could, he would go up there sometimes and just like have a hard time for like a half an hour. And then he'd just chip away and build that shit out. Like, you know, he would just take the hit until it started to make sense. It was kind of amazing.
I think that it was like that after he burned up and was trying to like still do it and do it sober.
Right.
I think it was harder to put it together when he was sober. It was harder to do. And when he wasn't sober, that's when it's like, you know.
Yeah, right.
When it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, where's it coming from?
That's when it was effortless. Before he was sober, it was effortless.
Yeah,
and that's when people, you would see Richard, and they would, so you'd see him do an hour, and then you see him a week later, and he'd do a whole nother hour of shit you never heard. Back then, he was like that guy.
So when you did Delirious, and you had, you know, you worked out that hour and a half on the road, you did it Richard style.
I had been doing stand-up. What's funny was when I got on SNL, people in, like I said, there's no real comedy circuit back then, no, where you're on TV and all that. So people didn't know I did stand-up.
Yeah.
So when I popped up in Delirious, that was like out of nowhere. It was like, whoa, what the fuck is this?
Really?
Absolutely. It was like, he does stand-up? No one had a clue.
Oh my God, it's like a secret weapon.
Yeah, it was out of nowhere. I showed up in a red leather suit doing all this shit. It was like, what the fuck?
Oh man. And then, and so now you've got, now you, that profile just raises. So now you're this movie guy, you're SNL guy, now you're the stand-up guy. And it seemed like there was a point, like, what was the thing with Dick Cavett, dude? Were you guys really friends? It seems like you really had some weird relationship with Dick Cavett.
I used to hang out with Dick Cavett a lot. I did a lot of stuff with Dick Cavett. He would pop up. I don't even know when that was the first time.
Yeah.
But he would just pop up. Like you would like be, you know, backstage SNL, and Dick Cavett would just pop up and say, how are you?
Yeah.
And you say, hey, Dick. And you start talking. And he's a guy that if you dare him to do anything, he will do it.
Yeah.
So I got into these things where I was daring him to do, like, we went to go see Diana Ross at the Garden.
Yeah.
And Dick Cavett, I'd say, I dare you to go up on the stage and grab Diana Ross's ass.
Yeah.
And he just says, why are you doing this to me? And then he gets up and walks and goes, and you're sitting, and then you see Dick Cavett coming from the side on the stage, and Diana Ross said, oh, Dick Cavett. And he came in, and he started hugging her and dancing with her, and then he put his hand on her ass, and he came back. So he was that guy. And so that became our relationship. I dare you to do this. I dare you to do that.
Oh my God.
Once we were in SNL, and a dude, Eddie Grant from, so he made that song. We're going to rock down to Electric Avenue. He had all the dreadlocks. Okay, so they come to Saturday Night Live, and the whole dressing room is all people with dreadlocks. It's back in the early days before, you know, dreadlocks was popular.
Yeah.
So everybody was kind of like scared. And Dick Cavett was like, well, look at their hair. And all I was like, yeah. He says, how did they get their hair like that? I said, I don't know. He says, someone told me that they use goat shit in their hair to get it that way. And I said, hell no. I said, I dare you to go into the dressing room and ask him, does he put goat shit in his hair? And he goes, why are you doing this to me? And then he walks down the hallway and he goes, and I'm standing in the doorway. Yeah. He goes into the makeup room and all these Jamaicans are standing around, and he walks up to Eddie Grant and he stands next to me. Eddie Grant is here. He goes, he starts a little conversation. He goes, hey, your hair is so interesting. He goes, oh, yeah. He said, how do you get your hair like that? And he goes, the guy tells him, we just do this, whatever he says. How we do. He says, really? Because someone told me that you use goat shit to get your hair like that. And the room goes quiet, and he looked at him and said, nah, man, that's not true. Then Cavett looks at me and says, why'd you tell me that? And walked away and left me standing in the fucking door. So he said, and he would pop up, and he'd come to my house and stay for the weekend.
Really?
He would just pop up. Yeah, he would just pop up and be like, hey, then you're hanging out with Dick Cavett.
That's so funny that you had this weird relationship with Dick Cavett.
Yeah, he would pop. But I've been around Dick Cavett quite a bit. I've been to concerts. Been to a sumo match. With a sumo match with Dick Cavett.
Do you talk to him still? Is he all right? I wonder if he's all right.
I haven't seen Dick Cavett in about 10, 15 years.
Who do you hang? Who do you keep in touch with from the old days? Anybody?
Oh, you know, the older I found, the older that I get, the smaller my circle of friends get.
Yeah.
You know, and the friends that I do have, the few friends that I still do have, they're like friends from, you know, 30, 40 years.
Is Fruity still around?
Nah, he been out of the picture.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, I was watching old TV shows.
That's a dude I went to high school. I went to high school with him.
But some of the cats you hang out with, they're old time. Like I noticed in the new movie, you pulled back everybody. You got everybody back in there.
Sweetwater, the dude, one of the barbers in the show, the guy that's not Arsenio, the other guy, Sweetwater.
Yeah.
He's my best friend from high school.
Really?
We're not still like that, but when we were in high school, we were like best buddies. He was in a bunch of stuff. He was on Saturday Night Live, sketches, and he's in the very first movie in 48 Hours when Nick Nolte comes and gets me out of the cell. That's Sweetwater in there, and Trading Places when I'm in the cell. I'm saying I'm a karate man, dude. That's Sweetwater's the one that goes, yeah, it's a phone, his limo is busted. What are you, ignorant?
That guy.
So yeah, that's the guy. He's in Coming to America. He's the other barber, and he was in this one too.
And also Louis Anderson, I notice, is back.
Yeah, Louis Anderson in a dashiki.
Yeah.
The movie is worth seeing just to see Louis Anderson in a dashiki.
Well, you know, honestly, I was thinking about the first one, you know, and trying to put it together, like, because it seemed to me that, like, over a period of time, even though, you know, everything was going good for you and you were amassing a lot of leather clothes, but, like, it seemed to me like the first Coming to America, like, could have been, I always got the feeling as I watched the appearances over time that you started to be resentful of being trapped by not your own success, but just that you just seem to be sort of angry about maybe the visibility or the expectation or what? What do you look at when you look back? What do you think you were pissed off about?
I don't know. I don't know that I was ever pissed off. I've never been.
You don't feel like you were pissed off?
No. How old was I? We talk about when I'm in my 20s.
Yeah, yeah. It just felt like, you know, like by the time Raw it comes out, like I imagine it would have to be hard to know what you were really, if people were just reacting to you, your celebrity, or to what you were doing. You know what I mean? I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the reasons why I stopped doing stand up, because it turned like, it was like you couldn't really tell how funny it was. Like, am I funny, or is this like, you know, some Pavlovian shit? You know?
Yeah, right,
you see
right.
Me and you just think you're laughing. So it was like, I remember one night I was at, I don't know, a comedy store or a comic strip, and I get on stage and the audience is like, just before you do anything, and I was like, what the fuck? And it was what the fuck? And I was like, so I don't have to do nothing. I can just stand here, you fuckers, and just laugh. And I just stood there for like 10 minutes and I killed. Just didn't say anything. I just standing there. People would be a little quiet. And then I look around and then a laugh would come again. And for 10 minutes, I was able to just, you know, look around and just make a stupid face and go. And I was getting laughs doing that. And I was like, hey, you know what? It's time to take a little break.
Yeah.
It's time to take a little break from it.
Right.
Hey, you know what? I tell you what. Now, that's everybody has that. Now doing comedy is so mainstream that the audience knows, you know, it's like you're the comic. Think how many times you see somebody doing shit and they're not funny or they're not kid, but the audience knows this is where I laugh.
Yeah.
It's never silent. I don't care how bad the comic is. It's never silent. They get something. They say something, laugh. So everybody has that problem now. That's why you gotta go by what you think is funny and what your gut is and what if it makes you laugh, and that's it. But if you try to, you know, figure these fuckers out, because they're just laughing at whatever you say.
Right, and then it's fundamentally like the one thing that used to be satisfying, because you know you did something, you can't trust it, right? So that's got to be fucking frustrating. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if I can just sleep through this and you guys are going to laugh, I mean, what the fuck am I doing up here?
Exactly. So I stopped doing it. But I didn't get frustrated by it. I was like, hey, you know, y'all ain't, this is not what it was. So I'm going to do I'm gonna talk to animals now. I'm Dr. Doolittle.
It felt like there was a couple moments in Raw and a couple moments on TV shows where you were like trying to push them a little bit, you know, trying to defy them to laugh at you, like, you know what I mean, like, you know, like, I'm gonna act this way to see how much you guys will take.
Oh no! If I came across like that, I was just being a real asshole at the moment. You gotta remember my shit jumped off really, really big, and I'm a really young guy.
Yeah,
so, you know,
you're right. There's
all of that. It's a lot of stuff that I have to navigate. It's like,
sure,
literally have to, you know, go through this minefield.
Right, right.
To get to, you know, this moment.
To get to the moment you're at now.
Just to get through, you know, that whole being in your 20s and being famous, and, you know,
it's amazing,
the precarious journey.
Yeah, but you've held it. You've held the vessel together.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to say, though. It seemed like at that time where you, like, stand up, you'd had enough of it. It seemed like Coming to America, the first one, was almost like a personal fantasy film. The idea that maybe, you know, I could go someplace where no one knew me and just be a regular person.
Yeah, that's the premise of the movie. On the tour bus, I got that idea. And it's a fairy tale.
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't it be nice, though? But it was a passing thought.
This new one, who wrote it? Who wrote it with you?
When I got the idea, I went back and got the original writers, Barry Blousey and David Sheffield, who wrote the original
one. Yeah.
And we talked it and got like a structure. They're really good at getting your story structure. And so we got that together. Then we brought in Kenya Barris. From Blackish.
Yeah, I talked to that guy. He's a smart guy. He's funny, huh?
Yeah, he brought him in and he made it a Coming to America-ish.
Yeah.
Because we got the older writers with the structure and he was like the new hot shot and I was in the middle, you know. And it took 4 years when we got a good script.
The story's great. I mean, and you know, yeah. it's almost like a all ages kind of movie thing. You know what I mean? It's almost,
yeah, man.
It's like it could almost be like a classic fantasy movie.
Yeah, but it took 4 years to get that script like that, and it was different. It was a bunch of different stuff.
How did it evolve? What was the problems?
It wasn't problems. It was, you know, when I was writing, when I got the idea, Tracy Morgan was going to be my son. So we were writing for Tracy Morgan. And in an original script, that I had a son. I wanted to take other wives.
Yeah.
It was like we picked up with the story and I wanted to take other wives. And it was like, oh no, that'd make them hate him. And so we wrote a version like that, and we didn't like that. Then we wrote, like, kept writing. You know, every time we finish a draft, we'd be like, this isn't right, but this little chunk right here, it works. And we kept doing that to where, you know, we had a bunch of chunks that worked.
Right.
And what really made it was this is when the narrative came together, when we saw, I think it was one of those Schwarzenegger movies, the Terminator movie, where they made him look young and he showed up and it looked like the old Schwarzenegger. Everybody was like, what the fuck? That looks so real.
Yeah.
And I was like, yo, that's when I saw that. You could take that make you look young shit and we could go and make another scene where, you know, back in that scene when we were out in the club looking for chicks.
Right.
We could say later on that night, we use that young special effect. And that's when the whole story clicked together and we got that little piece.
Oh, technology. Open the door.
Yeah, open the door to the story.
It's so funny that you got those twins back for a couple for 30 seconds.
And we got them. And that's the original Sexual Chocolate. Those are the original Sexual Chocolate members.
The band?
Watson's band. That's all original. Randy
Watson.
All original members.
That guy. You know that guy.
Yeah, he makes me laugh the most of all the characters. I have a lot of that in movies. I have a lot of movies where I'm singing stupid. The Donkey and Shrek is always singing.
Yeah.
I got a lot of scenes in movies where I'm singing bad. I've kind of worn that joke out, but it always makes me laugh when someone's doing that. And Randy Watson is the king of it.
Well, Randy Watson is like, as a character, it's almost like somebody you know from show business. I mean, there's plenty of Randy Watsons out there, man.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, especially locally. You know, every local town has a, what do they say? You know, what do they introduce him in the first? You know him as Joe the Policeman from the What's Going Down episode of That's My Mama. You know, there's a bunch of guys that had little roles like that. And now they're in the local town, the local celebrity.
Yeah, it's like comedy is full of those fucking people, man.
Yeah.
I really liked the movie, and I thought Leslie and Tracy were amazing.
Amazing.
I mean, Leslie Jones, she is like
amazing.
So raw and natural, and when she can just do her thing, it's like holy shit. So funny, man. And Tracy's such a, you know, it's nice. He controlled himself for that movie. I was very happy. He focused.
Yeah, well, he has a like I said, we worked on that script for 4 years, so he's got a script. Everybody that's on it has a, you know, they got a well, you know, worked out character, and
yeah,
got good words, and and Craig Brewer, the brilliant director. It was easy to focus and to do it.
And your daughter's in it?
Yeah, my baby girl is in it.
Ah. Yeah, man. Was that the first time you worked with her as an actress?
That's the first time any of my kids have been in any of my stuff. And that was the first, and I can't even put into words what that's like. If you have kids, you know, you go see your kid at something at school,
right?
And it'll fill you up. You know, your kid could paint something, and put it on a refrigerator, and eyes get wet from that. So imagine going to work, and your baby girl is at your job with you. And she's contributing to what's going on.
Yeah.
And she's doing a good job, too.
Yeah.
And she's got fight scenes and doing all this karate fight scenes and stuff. Like, every day, I was just filled up every day.
That's beautiful.
Every day. Yeah, man.
Can I ask you about, like, when you talk about Randy Watson and we talk about these movies, what was it that, like, made you want to tell Rudy Ray Moore's story?
I thought from the beginning, first of all, I used to watch his movies all the time.
You did?
Because I watch a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't watch just the classic stuff. I watch the classic stuff, and I love the stuff that's so bad it's good.
Yeah.
Those movies.
Right.
The movies that are like so bad, that I love movies like that. And Rudy Ray Moore was that.
As a kid,
even before I thought like that, like I love the so bad it's good. I was a fan of Rudy Ray Moore's movies because of that when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And when his movies were coming out, we would all go and we would laugh at seeing the microphone come into the shot and, you know, the certain way he would hit certain lines. We thought it was a snare. We knew it was bad back then. As kids, we knew it was horrible.
Right.
But it was funny. And we would argue, even as a kid, I would argue that that he's trying to be funny.
Yeah.
And they would say, no, he's not trying. He's serious. And I'll say, no, that he's not serious. He's trying to be funny. And that's why we're laughing. And they would be like, nah, he's serious. Yeah. They were laughing, thinking that he was serious. It was so bad. I was like, no, we're supposed to be laughing. There's no way that we're not supposed to be laughing.
Yeah.
Even as a kid.
Yeah.
So I was always a fan of his. And then I thought he had this great Stranger Than Fiction story. So we tried to get it done. It was back in the 90s when I first tried to get it done. I went to Rudy. But no studio was making no Rudy Ray Moore movie back then. It was like not happening.
Right.
Then, you know, enter Netflix 10 years, 15 years later. And then it was a place where, you know, make the movie.
So it was really about a guy who was committed to his vision and made it happen.
Absolutely. Rudy Ray Moore is another reason why he's a kind of fascination for me is his career is like the exact polar opposite of my career. Like the way he came on and what he had to do and how hard it was for him to get in. And, you know, it's like we did the same thing. We're both doing comedy. We both do music stuff. We both, you know, went into the movies. But he had such a hard time getting in there. And I was the sensation. And he was, you know, struggling in there. So he was, you know, fascinating in that respect. And then I had, once I got into the movie business, I had a newfound appreciation and respect when I found out that he put his movies together and that, you know, they would finance out of his own pocket and that, you know, he was like this guerrilla filmmaker.
Yeah.
So he wasn't just a nut. This guy really was, you know, trying to get it done. And so I was like, this guy's a great movie. It was like just like Ed Wood is a great movie about this in an Ed Woodsian kind of way.
Yeah.
I thought his story would be great. So I literally went and got the writers that wrote Ed Wood to write the Dolomite. Yeah, that those guys wrote it.
Yeah, I thought it was great, man. And you didn't know Rudy?
Nah, different world, different universe. I met him a couple of times, but I didn't know him.
Where'd you meet him?
The very first time I met him was on downtown LA. We was doing 48 Hours.
Yeah.
I heard somebody say, "Get your hands off me." And then somebody said, "I look like Rudy Ray Moore." And I was like, "That is Rudy Ray Moore." And he was real. He must have been smoking or something. He was like really skinny and looked like a homeless person. And I took some pictures with him and shit. I was like, wow. Then I would see him. He would do little gigs in LA, like at the Lingerie every now. He would play there on Sunset. And the last place I seen him was Stevie's on the Strip in Ventura Boulevard, like in the 90s.
Yeah.
So whenever he was another one, like we would go see Richard because it was Richard. Whenever he was in town, all the comics would go and sit around. And Rudy Ray Moore was the same. With the black comics, we would go, me and Keenan and Arsenio and Robert Townsend. And when Rudy Ray Moore came to town, we would go to wherever he was and sit in the back and be fucking screaming.
It was funny.
It was Rudy Ray Moore. He would go up to a woman and say, "Girl, close your legs while I eat off your drawers." You know, we were like, "What?" And then we go, "Hop, hop, 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 hop. I'm gonna eat off your drawers, woman." Hop, 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 hop. We were like, "Ah!"
What about? Did you ever see Red Fox?
Not live. Oh. No,
he was something, huh?
Yeah, but yeah, he was something on the set of Harlem Nights. On the set of Harlem Nights, you got Red Fox, Richard Pryor, me, Robin Harris.
Oh, Robin.
My brother Charlie, my Uncle Ray, and it was just raucous. Arsenio, just raucous laughter. Like the funniest shit happened off camera.
Oh.
We're always laughing. Red Fox is at the center of it. Red Fox is the funniest, just naturally funny, sit in the room, just naturally funny, not trying to be funny, but just funny. Everything that comes out of his mouth is just funny.
Yeah.
He just reeks it. That's Red Fox. He just reeks funny.
He exudes
effortlessly.
It.
Just not even trying. He could be mad. And everything he does is he says it turns into comedy. The whole room is screaming. He was that guy.
I love that, like, you know, that you're so rooted in stand up, like, you know, because I love that. And I know that you met Rodney early on.
Oh, yeah.
and he gave you that. I heard about that. That to me is the greatest story, because every old comic, if you're dirty, some old comic's going to come up to you and go, "Hey, what are you doing, kid? You got to clean it up."
Yeah.
You know?
And Rodney, that was weird for him to be like that with me, because he wasn't like that with people like Kennison, those guys, he championed them. But when he saw me, he was like, "Hey, kid, you know, you gotta clean your show up, kid. I tell you."
and then you ran into him later?
Yeah, it was before Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
I ran into him after like 3 years after that.
Yeah.
At the bathroom at Caesar's Palace. Well, the first night it happened, when he told me, you know, like, you know, I went to the comic strip in Fort Lauderdale to do this a weekend, and Dangerfield pops up.
Yeah.
And he was like, "Dangerfield's bumping everybody."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, Dangerfield goes up and bumps." And I'm like, "Mr. Dangerfield, will you watch my set?" Because I wanted to go up because I knew I was going to kill.
Yeah.
So I go up after Dangerfield and I crushed it. And, Dangerfield's like,
"Yeah, you know, kid, it's okay, but you know, you say that nigger stuff, and you know, you do a lot of foul language, you know, where are you going to go with that, kid? You know, you clean it up and stop using that word." And blah. I was like, "What the fuck? Wow. Thanks."
Yeah.
then I, you know, forgot about it. Then a year later, I got Saturday Night Live. 2 years go by. Then I'm at Caesar's Palace in Vegas, and at the urinal, and Dangerfield comes in, and he's right next to me. And I look over, it's Dangerfield. He looks at me and says, "Hey, who knew?" It was like perfectly timed, like a perfectly timed joke that he even remembered
right.
That he told, because I'm just one of a thousand comics, you know, that he even remembered.
Right.
And he didn't think much of my show back then, but he even remembered.
"Hey, that's a kid. Yeah, oh, man. Yeah, he's a what?"
And that he even remembered, and that he would come in and hit that like it was written.
Right.
Like,
"Hey, who knew?" It was like,
you know, tagged it 3 years later.
Yeah, boom. Yeah, perfect.
So
what's going to happen, man? What's going to happen with, you know, there was some, I read some bit that you told about that I thought was kind of beautiful, that you, you know, in terms of your the sort of the arc of the comedy history, that you say, you said that Groucho informed Cosby, Cosby informed Richard, Richard informed you. You know, that there's this through line.
Did I say informed?
No. I'm inspired. Saying that. But inspired, the engine. The engine of Cosby was Groucho. The engine of Pryor was Cosby. And the engine of Eddie is Pryor, right?
It's more than the engine. It's like the engine of those other people, it might have been like that. But then when it's Richard, Richard changes it. It's not like you just become your engine because she was influenced by him. Richard restructures the whole thing.
Right.
And it's not just me. He changes everything. He takes it from, you know, from black and white to in color, the whole art form. He changes. He takes the ceiling and puts it up here. You know, comics used to just stand there and tell their shit into the mic, you know, with their little suede patches on their elbow. And Richard is the one that made it three dimensional and used the whole stage. And so he opens it up how you can perform, and he opens up subject matter. He opens it up. He just opens it up. He makes the canvas like this big giant thing. And we were, you know, working on a stool.
Right.
And he made it as big.
Yeah.
And everybody just, he's like, no, you could do this. Oh. Richard changed. So he wasn't just my engine. He like changed. Like I said, he's what Brando was as an actor.
Sure.
Brando showed up and changed everything. That's what Richard was.
So are you going to go back? Are you going to do the hour again? You think after the plague?
The plan was, because I had stopped making movies in 2011. I was like, let me take a break from movies. So I was making these shitty movies, and it was like, this shit ain't fun.
Yeah,
they giving me Razzies. I think the motherfuckers gave me the worst actor ever, Razzie. Some shit. It was like, hey, maybe it's time to take a break. You get the worst actor ever, Razzie. Maybe I need to pull back. Maybe it's time to pull back a little. So I was like, let me take a break from it.
Yeah.
And then I was only going to take a break for a year. And all of a sudden, you know, 6 years go by. And I'm like sitting on the couch. And I'm like, hey, you know, I kind of could sit on this couch and not get off it. But I don't want to leave it. You know, the last bunch of shit they seen me do was bullshit. So I was like, let me get off the couch and do some stuff and remind them that I'm funny.
Right.
And then if I want to come back to the couch again, I could do that. But so the plan was to go do Dolomite, Saturday Night Live, do Coming to America, and then do stand up, and then see how I felt afterwards. But, you know, I was like, at least they'll know that, you know, I'm funny.
Yeah. Again.
Because otherwise, if you sit on the couch, they don't know you're sitting on the couch. They're just thinking, yeah, he fell off. He ain't funny no more or some shit.
Yeah.
Last movie he did. See his last movie, Pluto Nash? Yeah, then he went and hanged him. Didn't sit on the couch since then.
Wondering what happened.
I didn't want to leave it there. Yeah. It was like, let me go, you know.
So it might happen.
Might happen. We had a tour lined up. And we had dates and all that shit. And then the pandemic hit, you know. So now it's like, when the world gets back to normal and people can be around each other, put that stuff together. I still want the same plan. I did everything else. All the other stuff came together. And, you know, and now as I still wanted to go and do that, because I stopped doing stand-up when I'm 28. So I'm
wow.
Like, I'm 59. I'm going to be 60 in April. So I'm like, this, I want to bookend it. I'm curious to see what it'd be. What will it be like? You know, because I was a baby when I did it before. It's like, when I get some structure to my little thoughts and go and get on stage and do it again, I want to see what it's going to be like.
Wow, man.
And it'd be cool. It's kind of like bookend on it.
Yeah.
Then if I want to go sit on the couch, cool.
Yeah.
You know, pick my shots. When I say sit on the couch, that's a metaphor for, you know, just not chasing it. And if something comes along that's amazing, you know, to get some opportunity to work with some amazing artists or something, or some amazing director, of course, you know, I'd get off the couch and do that. But the whole being out there doing, you know, 3 movies a year and doing all that shit is over.
Yeah, don't need it anymore. Yeah.
George, you know, like I said, I'm going to be 60 in a couple of weeks. You know, I got all these babies. I got, you know.
You love it? You love the fatherhood thing?
Oh, yeah, man. That's at the center of everything.
That's beautiful. It's nice that you found that, and you found it over and over again, 10 times.
Over and over again. And then along the way, I realized that if you put your children first,
yeah,
you never make a bad decision.
That's nice.
If everything, when you get to wherever, I got to, okay, well, you have some crossroads moment, or you got some shit. Okay, well, what's best for my children? If you go that route, you never make the wrong decision.
And you get along with all of them?
Hey, you know, Mark, I am so blessed with my kids. I don't have one bad seed. I don't have one, you know, or you're the one. I don't have any. My kids are so great.
And that's great.
Normal people, and nobody's Hollywood jerk kid. None of my kids are so, and they're smart, and they're trying to do stuff.
Yeah.
I'm so blessed with my kids.
Well, great, man.
Really, really got lucky.
Well, that's great, man. It's great talking to you, and congratulations on the movie. It was really an honor to speak to you. I've always had a lot of respect for you, and it was fun, man.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Nice talking to you too, bro.
Take care, man.
You too, man.
Bye.
Stay safe.
There you go. Eddie Murphy, what a blast. What a fun thing to just be engaged in talk with Eddie Murphy for an hour. The movie is Coming to Number 2 America. That's a sequel of Coming to America. It's now streaming on Amazon. I will let you know what happened at the Critics' Choice Awards. You're going to know before me if you're listening to this. All right, here's some dirty rhythmic blues work. Blues work. Monkey and La Fonda. Cat Angels coming in for landing. Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.